very active in service, and I like to make sure that that service is brought out. Our relationship with Pat and Cliff goes back a number of years. We first heard them in Scottsbluff, Nebraska in 84 or something like that, when they came and spoke at a roundup out there. So Sheridan and I were delighted when Bill asked us to be the chairman for their two meetings and to host them, because we have had a chance to visit, and I always enjoy visiting with Pat and swapping stories and getting her guidance on things. When they came to speak in South Dakota, which Cliff alluded to in his talk yesterday, and by the way, South Dakota is a very fine place. It really is. He made some libelous and scandalous and spurious remarks about South Dakota. But anyway, when they came to visit us, having seen them before, Pat said, well, now, when you take us out, we want to make sure that you take us out, so we want to see some buffalo. So we took them to Wind Cave State Park and Custer State Park, which is where they have a very large buffalo preserve, and we pulled over to the side, and Pat got out and was wandering out around among all these buffalo, and that's not a really smart thing to do, because, they can squash you flat in a moment, but she was really taken with the buffalo, and here started a tradition, and any time I come across anything having to do with buffalo, I always send them to her. We sent her pins, and I have Far Side calendars, and here's this, there are two Indians, and on the tree up there is a buffalo that is hanging over him like a vulture waiting for the Indian to die, which I thought was sort of appropriate. And I happen to notice this month's National Geographic features an article on buffalo. And she's even wearing a buffalo pin. So anyway, they went home, and I want to tell you, Pat is a wonderful person, as is Cliff also, but she's really unique. And we got this thank you note, and I've got to read this to you. One of the things that she had said during this conference in South Dakota was, as a child, she had felt depraved and deprived, I guess. Deprived by never having had a wood-burning set. So, of course, she got a wood-burning set from one of the members of the party, and then about a week or so later, we got this official-looking letter from the treatment center, I guess it is, where treatment facility where she was working, and it reads as follows: memo to all staff from executive director regarding Patricia Roche. It has become evident to the management team that one of our members, staff therapist Patricia Roche, has been exhibiting occasional pathological behavior. While the ideology of this behavior has not yet been determined, it appears to be a regression to childhood that is being manifested in obsessive compulsive conduct concerning a wood-burning set. Ms. Roche has also been observed in a labile syndrome, fluctuating between hysterical laughter and a trance-like dissociation while holding an object she terms a buffalo chip. While we feel that appropriate treatment will be effective in her case, we are requesting that the frontline staff withhold all counseling referrals until further notice. Meanwhile, your cooperation is needed when you observe Ms. Roche in this condition. Please reassure her that you too think that her buffalo chip is extremely humorous, or if she is in a dissociative state, allow her complete quiet until it passes, and it will pass. As to the wood-burning set, simply treat her as you would any child who has just received a new toy. Thank you for your cooperation in this matter. Now, that has got to be the most original thank you note I think that anyone has ever sent. This month's catalog from Wireless of Signals has a T-shirt in it, and it says on there, "This is no ordinary woman you're dealing with." This is no ordinary woman you're dealing with.
I haven't got a chance. My name is Pat Roche, and I'm a grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. And I really like saying worldwide, because lucky us, as Cliff said yesterday, we live in San Diego, practically, and we're going to have our international in San Diego, and the Al-Anon theme is Al-Anon, Worldwide Hope. Isn't that beautiful? So we're promoting this weekend. We're not attracting, we're promoting. And if you want to call in the Al-Anon police, go ahead. And actually, John's been very generous because he's been announcing this. And I brought one order form, and they made hundreds. I mean, you guys don't fool around. And then our darling, adorable Dora, the fence sitter. She is modeling one of our T-shirts. Now, isn't she cute to do that? And I'm sure you realize that. Thank you, Dora. That's lovely. I'm sure you realize. And I have a pin here that I'm going to get to Omaha Pat since I'm finished talking. Because she actually is a California kid, too. And it's just, you know, Al-Anon, they're always trying to raise money. And we have this hospitality room that we have to, and we don't have to, but we think we have to provide and keep up the reputation of Al-Anon hospitality rooms for 15 to 20,000 Al-Anons when they come out there next year. So we're going to feed you well. So this is what that's all about. And we're having a wonderful time. Cliff told you yesterday that he's the chairman of, for AA, he's the chairman of the, he's training all the volunteers. Now, I'm the Al-Anon chairperson, whatever that means. It doesn't mean anything. Everybody else does all the work, and I kind of sit around and say, where'd they go, you know? But he's going to teach 6,000 alcoholics to do what he wants. And I'm not going to miss a minute. We're very excited about that, and we love this program, and we love being able to see all these people, and we know you're all going to be in San Diego. Now, a few of you that we meet from time to time, we don't admit to always that we know. But these people, we attract them all. He saved this letter for 8 years. Well, and you are well organized. And when we first met Bud and Ann on Thursday night, we commented on that. We said, you guys, we could tell by the letters we get, and I'm sure some of the other speakers in the phone calls, you're so efficient. That's not always the case. And we do appreciate it. It's okay not to be perfectly organized. It's okay to have a few little things. Actually, Cliff, I was reminded because when Omaha Pat was reading, she stumbled over a word, which I love. I love it when we screw up, don't you? It's the thing we all do best. And when I was attending an AA meeting with Cliff, and they had asked a new AA member to read the traditions, which is a dirty trick in any event, you know. And he read, "Our leaders are but twisted servants." Isn't that true? And they didn't need to tell us that, did they? Cliff was the delegate for Alcoholics Anonymous at that point, and I was real clear that that was really true. He was one twisted servant during that. I don't know what he would have done without me. My home group is called Footprints in the Sand. We meet on the beach in Oceanside, California, Buccaneer Beach, at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. They'll have to get along without me tomorrow. It's a wonderful, wonderful group of people. And sometimes in the winter, we get a little winter out there, too. We don't get hurricanes, but get a little winter. It's a little chilly, but we don't notice it. We're real good at denial. And sometimes there are 15 of us, and sometimes in the middle of summer, there are 100 of us. And it's a wonderful group. And those are the people in my life that I need to be with very regularly because they know me. And you heard a lot of talk this weekend about honesty, about being able to be honest. And the biggest freedom, the most important freedom I've ever been given came through you people. And that's the freedom to be truthful. Eddie talked a lot about that the other night. The freedom to tell you the truth, to not have any secrets. And I don't have any. I really don't have any. Some of them would be probably kind of tacky to talk about from the podium, but it's not because I care, because that's a wonderful freedom you've given me. We also celebrate Al-Anon anniversaries in our area. That started about 24 years ago. My friend and I had a resentment. Good reason to start anything, as far as I'm concerned. We had sat there and watched our spouses get their one-year cake. And everybody was just carrying on. And they were wonderful. Now, they'd been jerks for the entire year. You want to know that. They hadn't had a drink, though. Oh, my God, all these things would go wrong. And they would say, just don't drink. Well, I had just not drunk a lot, too, and nobody gave me any credit whatsoever. So we started giving cakes for Al-Anon birthdays. Now, that's a lot of fun, by the way. Some of us are a little vague on when we came in. I was very clear when I came in for some reasons, but the only trouble with that is it opens the alcoholics up to a lot of suggestions as how to define an Al-Anon slip. Because they say, how do you know you haven't had a slip? Well, for one thing, you can't smell our slips, right? So we sort of, they were asking for trouble, but we like to do that. We really like to applaud ourselves, if you will, for sticking around Al-Anon, because I don't know why I stuck around. Well, one reason was because you let me help you. You let me organize you, and God knows you needed organization. I mean, it even says that you weren't organized. Right in the stuff you read, it said you weren't organized, and that's no way to run an organization. And I was very good at organizing. Just get me close to anything that needed organizing, and I'd do it. I don't know if some of you, I know some of you have, but some others probably have that, I don't know. I learned so many skills on my way to Al-Anon that later have made me good money, actually. This thing he read from the Child Abuse Treatment Center was, I could stand on one end of that thing. Eventually I was, of course, running the place. You know, no Al-Anon stays very long without being in charge. I'm sort of in charge. I had one whole part of it was my responsibility. And I could stand in that place on one end of it, and I couldn't even see all these people, and I could ask, is that social worker called that kid's the lawyer, and has this happened, is that, and I couldn't see him, and the executive director would come out and say, how do you do that? How do you stand there and just tell what all these people are doing or not doing without seeing them? Well, I didn't think I ought to tell her that, you see, you marry an alcoholic and you have these five kids, and then you keep track of all of them. And then you keep track of all their friends, and you keep track of all his friends. Then you have your mother come to live with you, who's also alcoholic, and you keep track of her and her friends. And the neighbors depend a lot on you, because they have rough lives, and I always could smooth out their mornings, and so you keep track of all of them. And I didn't tell her all that. I don't know that she would have understood, but I knew why I could stand at one end of that place to keep track of all the rest of them, because I'd gone through alcoholism in my life. And most of the time, it was a lot of fun. You know, if you heard Cliff talk, you know how he shouts out how much fun he had. He still does. And he says, Al-Anons have fun. See, we don't tell them any differently, do we? No. We're not about to give away our secrets of the kind of fun we have. Because I've had as much laughter in Al-Anon rooms as I have in AA rooms. Although I tried real hard to be an alcoholic. I didn't know that's what I was trying to do. Later, after he got into AA, I knew that's what I was trying to do. But, you know, he used to say to me, if you just drink a little bit more. Well, he didn't say quite that nicely. And I agreed with him. I thought, you know, this looks like a good idea. Boy, it just didn't work for me. If a person's alcoholic because they come from a long line of them, which I did, if a person is alcoholic because they consume enough booze, which I think I did, I should be an alcoholic, but I'm not. Now, I used to think that the reason I wasn't an alcoholic was just because I was wonderful. And then I came into Al-Anon, and you spoiled all my fun. And you tell me it was the grace of God. And, of course, it is. And I don't know what it's like to be inside the skin of an alcoholic, but I know what it's like to watch many people that I love a lot either destroy themselves or come very close to it with this horrible disease. And I can't imagine any worse disease. Those of you that live with it or are it know that. And so isn't it, again, fascinating how the very pain and the very fear that we go through bring us to places like this with the loving, safe people. I guess that's the way it's supposed to be. It's the way it turned out. It wasn't my plan. I met Cliff in college. Tells you a girl isn't safe anywhere. And I went to college in 1946. And if you're wondering how old I am, I'll tell you, I'm 66. I say that so you won't sit out there trying to figure it out like I do. And if you're surprised I'm 66, so am I. How did it happen? I wasn't paying attention. Here I am, you know. But it was a wonderful time to go to college. I grew up in a small town southeast of San Francisco, and everybody loved me, and I loved everybody, and I had a good family. My mother had a little drinking problem. It didn't bother me till I got in high school. I used to be careful about who I brought home. But my mom was a lot of fun. She really was a funny, funny lady. She was a writer, and she was always loving. The problem with her drinking was she'd get going on a little vodka and orange juice and kind of get sloppy, make a few phone calls that embarrassed us, which was, you know, in a small town. You have to watch that. And that was about the extent of it. And I was careful about who I brought home after school by the time I got finished with high school. And I know my dad was real depressed. I still have to say that. I've been in this program a lot of years, and I still have to say I don't think I had some of the terrible, terrible experiences that many of you have had, and I'm very grateful for that. She was alcoholic. There were problems with that. But I can't look back and know what to think of a time when I didn't feel safe in my family. And I think I was spoiled. But I went away to San Jose, and my family didn't have any money. So in those days, they didn't have student loans, and so I was working to pay for college. And you know, in 1946, the war ended. For some of you are old enough to actually remember that. Some of you, if you've read your history, you know the war was over, and all these GIs had come back from the service, and they were attending college. And there were lots of them, lots more of them than there were us little 18-year-old high school girls. And it was hog heaven, I'll tell you, because they were older, more sophisticated. And I had been raised to be patriotic, and they had been defending my life, they told me. And nobody much had lied to me, so I didn't have any reason to doubt that. And I had a blast. I had a wonderful time in college. Now, when I met Cliff, I cannot tell you that I fell madly in love with him the first moment I saw him, and I'm really kind of glad, because I really would have been sick if that had been the case. He was drunk, very drunk. He's not a person. I'm not one of those Al-Anons that gets to come up here and say I married this person, and then, much to my amazement, as time went on, they developed this problem. No, I'm afraid not. He was sickeningly, disgustingly drunk at a party, smashing glasses. And then my date, I said, "Who is that guy? What's he doing?" And he was using four-letter words. Now, we met in 1949. I was raised a little bit to protected. I was hearing those four-letter words because the GIs were coming back and using them, but I didn't really know which word meant which thing, you know what I mean? So I didn't use them because I didn't want to embarrass myself by saying them in the wrong place. But it was kind of exciting to hear him, and he was using those four-letter words, and he was smashing glasses, and he was angry. He talks about his anger a lot. I'd never seen anybody that angry. And I asked my friend who that was, and he says, "That's Cliff Roach," and he always does that when he gets drunk. Would that be enough? Of course not. 2 weeks later, you also met him, a lot of you, and you know, I mean, he was a drama major. That'll shock you, I'm sure. He's played in a lot of comedies. Funny, funny, funny man. I love to laugh. I grew up laughing a lot. I love to laugh. A couple weeks later, I'm walking across campus, and there he is. Now, I don't know if he remembered me. Probably not. But I remembered him, and we chatted, and a bee began buzzing about his face. As a bee will do, you know, they won't go away. And he started having a boxing match with the bee. Now, you had to be there, right? It's one of the funniest things I ever saw. I remember sitting, I had to sit down, I was leaning against a tree, laughing so hard, and of course the more I laughed, the more he performed. And the cars were stopping on San Carlos Street, of course they couldn't see the bee. And didn't bother him. And I just got to thinking, I don't think I'm going to let this guy get too far away. I married him for all the best reasons. I was just telling Jerry that the other day. I married him because he could talk like Donald Duck. That's very important to me. Because he could box with a bee. I also married him because it was my senior year and I was flunking out of college and I needed something to do. You know, it's funny because when Cliff and I look at our college careers, I wasn't the alcoholic. He graduated with honors and I'm plunking out in my senior year and I wasn't drinking that much. So isn't that interesting? Well, I was partying, folks. I was having a good time and I'd been real used to being able to just cruise through school. I'd certainly done that in high school and I had through the beginning part of college, but I just never had to study very much and it wasn't the same with all these GIs there. They were serious. And they presented me with some competition. And I wasn't obviously ready to settle down and really study. And at some point, the college got a little tired of that and said, "See you later." And that's the way I left college, with him in tow. Now, we knew he needed help. He would talk about, he'd have these episodes of drinking. He was protected by the people on campus. That's not unusual. The drunks on campus, and we live close to a Marine base, they protect each other. It's kind of normal at that age. And he was a very popular young man and very well known for his acting, and people protected him. So he got really bad drunk a lot of times. But he didn't want to get that drunk, he said. And so we talked about that. And he knew my mother had this drinking problem, and we talked it over, and we decided between us that I could help him. This was really more his idea than it was mine. And we thought that was true because, you see, very regularly, about every few months, my father would phone me at the college and say, come back up here on the hill, your mom's drinking again. She'll listen to you. And he was right. I was her favorite, which is probably why my sister was always mad at me and still is. And she's older, you know, and I came along and had the most fun with Mom. And I would do just what he asked. I would go out and I'd sit down with Mom and I'd say, you know, you're drinking a little too much, Dad says. And she'd always respond to that. She'd say something in agreement. She'd say, you know, I have been kind of, we never called it alcoholism. In those days we didn't. And she'd agree that it was time for her to stop that, and she would stop. I mean, she would stop. Now I want to tell you, I had the distinct impression that I had something to do with that. Cliff thought so too. It seemed kind of obvious after a while. When I got to you people, you taught me about periodic alcoholism. I didn't know there was such a thing. Now, it became obvious to me as time went by, but when you told me this, Mom was a periodic. She could go 3, 4, 5 months and not drink at all, very comfortably. Happy-go-lucky, cheerful lady, just chasing fire trucks. We did that kind of thing. She just was loads of fun, and then she'd get her vodka and orange juice. And for 2 to 3 weeks, she'd just kind of disappear. She's a little bitty lady, only 4'10". She'd kind of disappear in that chair. She made a lot of embarrassing phone calls, and sometimes she got real sloppy. And then the time would come where it was time to stop, and she'd stop. Now, if I hit it just often enough, when I was the one talking to her, then I felt like I had something to do with it. When I came in here, you told me the 3 C's of Al-Anon. And that's that we don't cause alcoholism, we cannot control alcoholism, and we certainly cannot cure alcoholism. But I didn't know that, you see, because it sure seemed to me that when I went out and talked to Mom, she quit drinking. I like to equate alcoholics to slot machines. You know, there's some of you here, I know, you pay off just often enough to keep us in there. Just enough. And I love the slot machines. Quarters, I'm kind of a cheapskate, you know, but I sit in those slot machines, and I'm sitting there, and I'm pulling away at this one, and I'm down to only maybe 4 quarters, and I look at the one next to me, and that's paying off an awful lot, and I'm thinking, maybe I ought to leave this machine and try another one, and then I think, no, I got too much invested in this one. Oh, how many times did I say, I'm going to leave that guy, and I think, no, I've got too much invested. But I stuck around for the jackpot, and I got it, didn't I? You guys gave me the jackpot. I did everything I knew to do to keep that man happy. He was the most unhappy, very funny. My mother was funny and seemingly happy. Cliff was funny and angry. And I really didn't know what to do with that. So he told me one of the reasons he got angry a lot is because he was very sensitive. And it helped if I could smooth things out a little so he didn't have to worry about some of the details of life. Sensitive artist, right? And we spent 6 years in Los Angeles while he pursued a career in acting, and they didn't appreciate him as much as I think they should have. And probably it's just as well, because we often talk about what would have happened to us if we'd been in that fast lane. But the fast lane didn't want us, which is, we said, was just as well, and we got AA instead. Thank goodness. But he also said that because he'd been raised in this terrible, terrible home with all this abuse, and his mother was a serious alcoholic, that if I could just kind of make up for that, you know, being his mother. And, of course, I was right up my alley. I was fine with that. He laughingly says that he found me in the gutter waiting for an alcoholic to come along and abuse me. Actually, he says that because the first time, almost 25 years ago now, when I rode up with all these alcoholics from Oceanside to Venice, California, about 100 miles, to visit his sponsor's sponsor, whose name is Clancy. I went in Clancy's backyard, and Bill, Cliff's sponsor, took me over, introduced me to Clancy. Clancy took me to introduce me to his wife, and that's the first thing he ever said to me. That loving man, he is a loving man, said, here's the, he called him the dummy school teacher, all one word, like you guys say, damn Yankees. Yeah, dummy school teacher. This is a dummy school teacher's wife. He found her in the gutter, waiting for an alcoholic to come along and abuse her. Now, this is at this point, I was a little bit leery of this weird bunch of people he had joined in with. Anyway, let alone getting insulted like that the first time I met him. Because I had all these years just been trying to keep that home dignified. Just a little dignity. And I didn't realize I'd married a shanty Irish. He hates that. That's a wonderful weapon to use on an Irishman. I have no idea what a shanty Irish really is, but it sure makes an Irishman mad. And so I love to think that. I'd say shanty Irish, you know. And Ed said something the other night, being a member of the CIA. I didn't know I'd married a member of the CIA, a Catholic Irish alcoholic. My father was a 32nd degree Mason. And in those days, they didn't mix the Masonic Lodge and Catholicism. And he was not practicing that religion, which made it nice because there was no great conflict, but he still had come from that background, and he was sure proud of being Irish, and I could sure get him when I wanted to that way. Now, one time he went back to the church, and I realized today, I didn't know then, that he was looking for a spiritual solution, and I've heard many alcoholics say this, that they were looking for spiritual solutions in many ways, and sometimes, many times in the bottle, I guess. But he went back to that church for a period of time, and you know, he got kind of nicer. I watched it, of course. I had to keep track of all this. I watched him. He quieted down a little bit. It seemed to me he drank a little less. He didn't seem quite as angry. And so I checked it out, and I decided I'd keep him there, so I joined it. That's the only reason I joined it. I just tried to keep him there, keep him happy, keep him spiritual. Then he'd be okay. Well, it didn't work, by the way. He didn't stop drinking, and he didn't get any more cheerful. But we do have 5 children as a result of, because I followed the rules. I grew up following the rules. It says stay off the grass. I stay off the grass. He goes crazy with me. We have a left turn light right outside where we live. And sometimes there's no traffic at all, and we come out, and if there's no traffic coming for, he says, 5 minutes. That's a ridiculous exaggeration. He'll turn if there's no cars. Not this Al-Anon. This Al-Anon waits till the green arrow comes on. Doesn't matter if it's 2 in the morning and there's not a cop in sight or a human being anywhere. And so we have our little tips from time to time. But you see, I follow the rules. And we have these 5 kids. And they have given me wonderful opportunities to practice my Al-Anon program. And we have best of grandchildren. And they have given us some wonderful opportunities to release alcoholism. And I guess that's the best thing that keeps us keeping, well, me anyway, keeping steady in this program, because God just doesn't let up on me. He just plops another one in my life as fast as possible. And I like alcoholics as much as I like slot machines. Slot machines are a lot cheaper, I'll tell you. I just got a mouthful of ice. Excuse me. Better to chew it than to swallow it. See, I travel with my own speech coach. I don't listen to a thing he tells me, but we moved to Oceanside. Well, I worked his way through teacher training. Did you pick up the wording? I am a member, by the way, of the Varsity Martyr Squad. I have a great big letter M, which someone gave me. I've been in Al-Anon about a year, and some loving Al-Anon gave me that, and I didn't think it was funny at all. Today I love it. But I began making sacrifices for this family and this man. And God knows he needed help. I worked his way through teacher training. He got a teaching job, a couple of them, and we ended up, and we've been 30-some years in Oceanside, California. He was teaching at the high school, teaching speech and drama and English. And these children then began, I don't know, they just weren't reading the rules the way I had, some of them. We had a couple who did. I got a kick out of the Miller family because when you have 5 kids, you got a mess of kids. I never knew who were mine. We lived in a cul-de-sac. All our children grew up with these 7 same families. Oh, my heart went out where you, when you talked about being taken off the carpool. We have a neighbor. We moved now. We had a neighbor named Shirley. Shirley drank too much. And Shirley was a campfire leader, Bluebird campfire leader, which is important. And she, I got a call one day as her neighbor from the campfire building asking me what I could do about it. She was due to come back and pick up these girls and take them home, and she'd been drinking, and they didn't know what to do. I was in Al-Anon by then, and I said, we need to tell her the truth. And I said, do you want me to, or do you want to do this? She says, no, we'll handle it. They never told her the truth. But I was really taken back to that time. If you didn't hear Christy speak this morning, you probably did, about when she got taken off the carpool. As far as I know, Shirley's still drinking today. But how it is hard. It's hard to do that, to tell somebody the truth. And I knew enough to do it then, but it wasn't my job to do it. They wanted to do it, and they didn't. Sorry, I digressed a little there. I just had to make a comment to Christy because it took me back a bunch of years. I got clipped to go to a psychiatrist. That's a pretty good trick if you could pull it off. And the psychiatrist prescribed the interviews, and that was nice. I didn't even know that stuff existed. And it's hard for me to believe I didn't know that existed because I had looked into everything I thought was possible to help him. And I figured out a formula. I have no idea. Well, I minored in science. I liked chemistry. So I got information about these interviews, and now by this time he and I both knew that he could not possibly go a whole week without drinking. So I got this formula together where I figured if I gave him one interview on Monday and one on Tuesday and a half of one on Wednesday, he could safely drink on Friday night. Now, I don't know if my formula was correct because he never made it till Friday night. He drank on Thursday night. And it's fun. Have you ever watched anybody drink on that stuff? Ooh, it ain't a pretty sight. And he'd turn all these colors and big red blotches. His heart would be, I like that part. He got real panic stricken, you know, I loved that. And he would just, and he would just glow. And it became a neighborhood, normal Thursday night neighborhood. The kids would say, let's go in and watch Mr. Roach glow on Thursday night. And he did. And he did. I find that I'd give him the interviews. Notice I said I'd give him the interviews in the morning, and he'd still drink that night, and then I figured out he wasn't swallowing it. He was making it out the door without it. So I began, have you ever given a dog a pill? You just stroke their throat till their Adam's apple goes up and down, and I'd pop that pill in his mouth, and I'd stroke his throat, and if his Adam's apple went up and down, I knew I was going to have a good day. Unless it was Thursday, of course, but... Now, the psychiatrist died. I could have killed him. He was my only source of help. And we had no supply. So we live in north of San Diego, which is close to the border of Tijuana. And I would place my small child, well, I always had a small child, in the front seat of my car, my station wagon, which my father had bought for us. God knows we wouldn't have had a car if he hadn't bought it for us. And I'd dress in my two-piece polyester pantsuit. This is towards the end of the 60s, folks. And my bubble hairdo. And I'd drive to Tijuana. And just like you drunks talk about, you'd go from one liquor store to another so no one liquor store would know how much you're buying. I go from one pharmacy to another buying antidotes. Of course, you get that across the counter down there. So they wouldn't know how much I was buying. Like they care. Like they really care. And then I would buy a piñata. And I would stuff the piñata with interviews, and I'd come back across that border, and I'd be waiting in that line because I was smuggling, thinking, well, this is a federal offense, and if they catch me this time, they'll probably put me in jail, and they'll take this small child and put her in a shelter, and then he'll appreciate the sacrifices I've gone to for him. And he has never thanked me for that to this day. I don't think he's going to tell you the truth. You know, for me, when I was losing control of all the things that I thought were important, and I just couldn't control them anymore, his behavior, I got him to school every morning, that was remarkable, kept track of his speech team. By this time, he developed a speech team. If you heard him talk, you know that he put a little time in on that. And the alert Al-Anons in the audience when he's speaking about that period of that, well, went on beyond that, but that particular period of time where he was building that speech team, often come up to me later and say, well, we know what you were going through when he was building the speech team, because if you're married to an alcoholic who's a workaholic at the same time, you know what I'm talking about, and the tension in that house.
just like this all the time. So I helped him, and he'd get on the phone at night trying to organize these tournaments and get parents to help, but of course he never remembered it the next day. So I had to keep track of that. So we only had one phone because we didn't have much money. Do I look pitiful? Mm-hmm. And we only had one phone, and so I'd listen. That's where I got the Al-Anon long ear, you know, listening, writing down all the promises he'd make. The next morning I'd send him off to school with his notes as to all the things he'd promised and his pill, which he didn't take anyway. And I kept track of that, and that was hard to do. We never had any money, so I began giving piano lessons. Well, I'd learned to play the piano as a kid, and I had a little talent, and I think I might be kind of a natural teacher, because before I knew it, I had 37 piano students. And now that got me kind of busy, too, because by this time, these children were growing, and they were discovering some interesting things on the streets. Not all of them, but as I told you, I couldn't always tell which ones were ours. By then, and those five kids came kind of fast, and so their friends were, and it's all these kids that were the same age, and they all looked alike. And in those days, in the late 60s, they had their hair parted in the middle, straight. They ironed it if it was curly, you know, and they wore wire-rimmed glasses, whether they needed them or not. Here's our little hippie right here. And they wore great big t-shirts and jeans with holes in them and no shoes and headbands. And some of them smelled kind of musty. That's what I thought it was. I thought they weren't washing their hair or washing their clothes at the time. I figured it all out later, and they smelled kind of musty. And so there were these kids all. And then in our family, they also wore great big peace medals. So did my husband, by the way, which was really hard to keep looking dignified. Actually, he looked a lot like them in some other ways, too, by then. And they had taken up some form of meditation, and they would go, om, and they would sway, all of them, back and forth, all these teenagers with this medal. And yeah, it makes you kind of crazy, it really does. And so they look alike when they do that. And I was very busy. When I got to Al-Anon, I was giving 37 piano lessons, as I say, a week. I was keeping track of his speech team. God knows he wouldn't have kept his job if it hadn't been for me. My mother had come to live with us. Cliff had invited her. They got along very well, you may be surprised to hear. My father had died. I say sometimes in these rooms that, you know, people die of alcoholism in many ways. That isn't called that. My father wasn't an alcoholic. He had had one heart attack, and he had a second one a couple years later. And my mother was so drunk that he lay on the bathroom floor, as best as we can figure out, about 6 hours before she was aware that he needed help. And she did get help, but it was too late, and he died. And we don't know, do we? We don't really know. The doctors told us that they felt like they could have done a lot for him if they could have gotten him sooner. My mom had to live with that knowledge. And I think, knowing, and the way I said it, you can tell I hope you can tell I have compassion for her. Even though I hadn't been to Al-Anon, somehow in me I knew that that is not what she wanted to be like. But she didn't want to have something like that happen. And she had to live with that knowledge. But anyway, Cliff had invited Mom to come live with us, and she was doing fine. She loved living with us. Boy, we had party going all the time. And Cliff would come home after school with his teacher friends. Mom was on a little walker. She'd broken her hip and didn't remember how that happened. She thought it was kind of odd it hadn't hurt. And I, being the pre-Al-Anon that I was, would take her to the physical therapist and get her this schedule of exercises, start with five, and you build your way up until eventually, so she could begin walking normally again. But being an alcoholic lady, she came home and did all 50 the first day, of course, couldn't walk for 2 weeks. And then, what's the definition of insanity? I'd take her back to the physical therapist, start all over again, assuming this time it'll be different. But Mom was our little walker, and she was a cheerful little lady and awful cute. Everybody liked her. And she'd walk around the block once every day. And she'd do that in the afternoon, and she'd bring home the low men. Nice little old men. I mean, she picked good ones. And most of them were really, and they'd come home with her after school, really. And Mr. Mills was a little hard take. He always dressed in a three-piece suit, tie, and he was elderly, and he was very gentlemanly, but it was hard for me to adjust to the great big spot on the front of his pants. Always had a spot on the front of his pants. With all the dignity, he just always had a spot on the front of his pants. And I tried, you know, to look away. I used to get him to pretend like I wanted him to cook. I put an apron on him, but then the apron would have a spot on it, you know, so I couldn't. But I'd be at my piano in an afternoon giving piano lessons, keeping track of this kid and how well they were doing. And in the middle of our house at that time would be our kitchen and dining room. And there would be Cliff and my mom and Mr. Mills and whatever teachers had come home with Cliff making margaritas. Now, they make those on blenders, of course. And if you've ever heard one put on the blender sideways, you know how noisy that is. I had three blenders went out with those jerks out there making margaritas. And I could listen. Well, I'd give these piano lessons. I could tell you which batch of margaritas they brought. I could also tell you which bedroom window had just opened, because our daughter's boyfriends had gotten in the habit of coming in and out of the bedroom windows. I don't know why. We had doors. Broad daylight, they were coming in and out of those windows. And those windows were lined up along one side of the house and the same side as my piano, and I could hear, and I could tell which window had opened. Then, Cliff mentioned, our oldest son was working his way through high school, as he says, selling hashish. And I knew it. Now, one of the best parts of my story, I love this part. Cliff really didn't know the kids were using any of this stuff at the time, and I wasn't about to tell him. That would really give me trouble. When I began figuring out what these kids were up to, the last thing I wanted was to bother with his knowing. I had to keep it a secret. So he just thought they were crazy. It would have helped him, I think, a little to tell him. He just thought they were crazy. But this son was selling hashish out the back door. I knew that, and I was trying to figure out a way to control that from the living room and the back family room. And so about every half hour, he'd have a sale, and about every half hour, a piano student would come in and go out. And meanwhile, the teachers and Mr. Mills and my mother would be in the kitchen making margaritas. And I could keep track of all those people. And the windows were opening, of course. So when I tell you I learned a lot on my way here, I'm not kidding. After I was invited to give a talk or two in this program, I took a tape home to my neighbor Helen, who lived with us through all this. Loving, wonderful lady, said, "Would you listen to this and tell me? I can't believe this." When I really started putting it together, so she listened, came over and says, "Patty, you left out the best part." She had a lot more to say than I did. But I just was trying to stay dignified in that household. I was trying to give dignified piano lessons and have a nice little dignified piano studio. Now, I wasn't married to a man who likes dignity too much. He was funny as hell. Funny, that's the trouble. You know, that's the slot machine again. You know, he was a surfer, and he'd go down and he'd surf off the coast of Baja, and one time he'd purchased a Mexican art object. It was a wooden Sandy knows the story of it. I hadn't thought of it. It's a wooden carving of a man's hand with a particular finger extended. Big one. He brought that home, and he stuck it on my piano in the living room. He said, "This is my house, and this is my philosophy of life." On your piano. Now, just to let you know how I'd lost track of my choices by then, I really didn't believe I had the right to take that off of there. That was his philosophy of life, and he had stuck it on my piano. But I was given piano lessons, you know, to these children. So each day I would sneak that thing out and hide it while I gave my piano lessons and get it back in there quick before he came back in the living room and noticed. That tells you what had happened to me, I hope. And that was kind of tiring. Actually, what happened with that was I missed it one day. You're bound to. You know, I had so much to do. And one of the parents asked if they could come in and watch their youngster take a piano lesson, and I didn't care. You know, I never cared. So I said, "Come on in," and she watched him. But, you know, I realized she wasn't looking at her child. And this was the wife of the Baptist minister. I saw where her line of vision went, and I never saw the family again. And I did not send them a bill that month either. I was a little too embarrassed to even do that. And I just want some dignity. But, you know, he'd do something just often enough to keep me in there, because I had my piano placed so that the students couldn't see the rest of the living room, but I could. And I had a student learning Humoresque, if any of you know music. That's a little dancey number. I look up, and here comes my husband through one door with a little pair of white shorts with red devils on, which I had given him, and a rose in his mouth, leaping. And I'm trying to seriously give this kid a piano lesson who has no idea what's happening. And he goes out the other door. Now, how can you leave a thing like that, you know? Just often enough. I was getting kind of tired, actually.
And I began finding these funny little pills around the house. My mother was a periodic alcoholic and a daily pillhead. She discovered Darvon and some of those good things, and she had plenty of that. And Cliff was a daily alcoholic and a periodic pillhead. He'd get prescriptions and take them all one weekend, and I was running around looking up antidotes to whatever it was. And I don't know why I did that. You know, looking back, I often think, you know, I would probably just have been just happy if he died. But I didn't want him to die in a way that would embarrass me. It needed to be something kind of glamorous, like maybe stopping on the freeway and helping a troubled car and being hit by the Marine Corps or something, because they live right there. And so I wouldn't have minded so much if he went that way, or went, but, it, you know, I needed to control how it happened. I was a little too afraid to plan it. I have a good friend in Al-Anon. Some of you, I'm sure, know her, Nell, from Oklahoma. And she talks about, before she came into this Al-Anon program, she was, she'd sit in her rocking chair, feeling precious and pitiful. And she would pluck the chenille off her robe. I was not a rocker and a plucker. Careful how you say that. I was a goer and a doer, and I did not want you thinking I was precious and pitiful. No way did I want you to think that. And I kept it up pretty well. Our son began taking hallucinogenics. Now, I had a friend on the police force, and I would run down there with these little cute things because I knew that he wouldn't do anything about it, I mean, legally. And I would say, "What's this?" And he'd tell me. Now, I don't know why I thought it helped me to know what it was, because it didn't change anything. We all know this now, but I thought it did help me because I always wanted to understand something, figure it out. And I would find these little white pills with X's on them. And then I'd find my little clippies for my hair with burn marks on them. Begin putting two and two together. And I could, you know, some of that stuff came in kind of handy, actually. When the kids smelled musty, they were real easy to get along with. They're just, everything's cool. "Sure, Mom. I could ask them to do anything." They didn't do it. And they ate an awful lot of food. But it was easy going. But when they had those little white pills with the X's, they were busy. And I could get them to wash my car and scrub my floors and do these things. So, you know, it was kind of, in some ways, it came in handy. You take what you like, you know, you can, whatever you can out of this. I have a snapshot memory, as I think just recently Sandy was saying about the Kodak moment. I have a snapshot memory. I think a lot of us do. I'm standing in my living room just before I came into Al-Anon, looking at that bunch. Now, it was about 7 at night. I had finished teaching. Cliff was sitting there talking to the television, which was not turned on. He still lives out today a little bit, and that's okay today. And see, I figured out he had a 20-hour lag time. He would, at 7 o'clock, he'd be talking to last night's 11 o'clock news. Because he'd get drunk at a certain time, pass out, wake up, hear the 11 o'clock news, go back to sleep again, and then the next night he's talking about the 11 o'clock. And just because our communication had broken down pretty badly, I was talking with him about it because we didn't have much else to talk about at that point. And my mother, of course, was on her little walker, but I see my oldest daughter, who is now an active member of Al-Anon, aren't the oldest of the families, just cut out to be that. She was always trying to feed us. She'd be passing out cookies. Always. Just, you know, she'd go make us all happy. And we'd feel better if we had something good to eat. And actually, I think the time she made the brownies, we probably did feel better, but I don't think, we didn't know why. And then the next kid in line, the one that was selling the hashish and taking LSD, was really, he'd really spaced out. He really did. And he'd see these little flashing lights. And if you've seen people that take hallucinogenics, you know, a lot of heads are going, yeah, you've either been doing it yourself or you watched it. And it makes you nuts. And he'd see these little lights and scare Cliff. He wouldn't know what it was David was seeing. And because David would jump, and he'd jump, and my mother would lean on her little walker and say, "I'll explain it to you." God, I thought, I guess so. There's something. And our next daughter in line, our middle daughter, Jan, who was the one that got the worst treatment from her father because she had such a big mouth, who, guess what, is now sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank goodness for you people. But she was coming on at that age, I'll tell you. And she was 14 when we got to this program, and she was angry. That you could feel the anger when you got near her. And I felt so awful about that, because I had not grown up feeling angry. I had no reason to grow up feeling angry. And my kid was angry, and I felt such a failure. And our son, Chris, who is one of the funniest human beings on the face of this earth, he is a riot. Funny little tow-headed blonde. And he could sing, and he could act, and he had all the talents of any of the two of us. He just got them all. And he could make his daddy smile if he stood on a chair and he imitated the great Irish tenor, John McCormick, with an Irish dialect and all the gestures. And then Cliff had produced The Sound of Music, and Chris would stand on this chair and sing Edelweiss at the top of his voice over and over again, and everybody would smile, and Chris would keep singing it over and over again because people kept smiling. And you know, of course, what he was doing, and if you know about families, well, we all know about families. Everybody's trying their best somewhere to make it better somehow. And then there was Mary, our youngest. Now, Mary is 32 years old now, and she was 7 when we came here. Mary, we always had a place in our living room, and we called it Mary's Corner. We'd take a couch and put it on a diagonal, and she put her stuff in the corner. She just kept her stuff in the corner. And Mary would play happily in her corner. We didn't hear much from her. She didn't give us trouble, and she also didn't make any wonderful attempts to make us feel better. She just stayed in her corner. We called it Mary's Corner. All of our kids, and Cliff and I, there's a place in the state of Washington called Mary's Corner. It's right off I-5 freeway. And it's just that. That's about all there is to it, is a couple of stores. Everyone in the family and some of our relatives and certainly a lot of our friends have taken a picture of Mary's Corner. She's got more pictures of Mary's Corner. But you know, that's because that was Mary's Corner. And I don't like to forget that, because to tell you about that, because I know a lot of people grew up in their own way in Mary's Corner. And Mary's okay today. She's the only one of the kids that isn't married. She's tended to find people with drinking problems. And she decided that that was going to be a problem. So she wasn't going to do much dating for a while. She keeps going to college and then changing her mind and going back again and changing her mind, and she's back in there again. She's a hard-working lady who takes care of herself very well. We love her a lot. She's a pretty well-adjusted lady. About a year and a half ago, she made a decision to volunteer to become what we call an AIDS partner. What that is someone who will be trained and walk through with the person who has AIDS and be their friend and their partner and their pal while they die. They've been deserted by their families, a lot of these people. When Mary told me she was doing that, my first inclination as a clinician myself was to find out what kind of training she was getting, and it was very good. And I asked her about it, and she said, "I have a lot of love to give, and I give it sometimes to the wrong people, and I think this is the best thing for me to do with this now." And she's been walking with this young man, his name is Glenn, for a year and a half. He almost died. She's got power of attorney, she's the one that'll decide. And he just had another spell in the hospital, and when he's in the hospital, and I can go down and sit with her in the waiting room and be with her. And you know, they have a phrase among the AIDS community, they call it being alive. Sound a little like one day at a time, being alive. And Mary says, similar to what we heard said this morning, I've never felt more fulfilled and more alive than when I'm with my dying friend. And that's what she's chosen to do. Now, as her mother, I probably wouldn't have chose that for this beautiful, blonde, talented girl who could do anything she wants to until I watched her do it. And I realized this is who she is. And you know, she was 7 when we got in this program, and she doesn't know much differently than our way of life. And she knew she needed to give it away. And that's what she's doing. And I have a great deal of respect. And I know she's going to go through more pain, but she knows how to do it. She knows how to do that. Our son, the Heshy Seal, went on to bigger and better things. He graduated with a bachelor's in agriculture. And then he spent 2 years in the Peace Corps in Colombia. Has God got a sense of humor? I mean, is this wonderful? Then he got his master's degree in viticulture, which is the art of growing grapes. And as a master student, he would also do some teaching at the University of Davis where he's going. And so he had the key to the enology lab, which is where they make the wine. It's very popular. At this time, and it's been a few years, he's had a very successful career. He graduated on the dean's list. I went up to see him one time at Davis where he was getting his degree, his master's degree. I said, David, how do you do this with all the pot you smoke? Because he did a lot of pot. And he says, I just don't smoke pot for about a week before finals. No. But anyway, he's got a very, very successful career. He lives in Maui, and he's got a lovely wife from Madrid and a beautiful daughter. And he's, I think I had an Al-Anon slip a few weeks ago. I'd been over there. I go over as often as I can, of course. And I've seen him drunk plenty of times. This time he wasn't drinking. He was sick. He was alcoholism sick. He was getting yellow, and he was sick. And he's so good at what he does. He's growing coffee, actually, on Maui, and they'll produce the first mass-produced coffee off of Maui. And next month I'm going to go over and watch the harvest. And but he was sick, and that was so hard for me. It was harder than seeing him drinking. He wasn't drinking right then, but I could see the poisoning. And I came home really depressed, and I had to really struggle with that. And I sort of sent up a little prayer. I said, God, let's give David a little incident. Just enough. A little DUI, maybe. Not enough to lose his wonderful job or his family, but so. But it wasn't much later that my phone rang in the middle of the night. Hawaii's a couple hours earlier than we are out there. And it was David, and he was drunk. And he said, guess what, Mom? Oh, my God, guess what? And I couldn't tell whether what it was, you know. I couldn't get a feel for it, except that he was drunk. And he said, I just got promoted to vice president, and I got a $22,000 raise. And my first thought was, God, that is not the incident I had in mind. And I don't think there's too many of us proud mamas that are wishing. I mean, I would run around cheering normally that my kid got that nice advancement in his work, but I'd much rather he got a DUI. Don't our values change after we get in here? The priorities get adjusted. What happened in my household was that I told you, I'm looking at this living room full of people. They're crazy. All of them are crazy. I'm responsible for the whole bunch. I had a dog, my favorite dog. His name was Siesta. He liked martinis. What can I tell you? You know, alcoholic dog. He had a great personality. But he was named Siesta because he slept a lot. And he had gotten in the street, and the car hit him and broke his pelvic bone, drunk in the street, I guess. I don't know. He couldn't move fast enough. And his pelvic bone was broken. He was a long, low dog with a lot of hair. I have no idea what breed he was. I know he was horny because we still got long, low dogs running around that neighborhood. And he's been dead a lot of years, you know. But he managed to get around in spite of his martinis. But he had broken his pelvic bone, and he was supposed to be kept at cage rest, which means we just had to keep him in a playpen. We always had playpens. Right? But he couldn't hold his rear end up in the backyard to do what he had to do in the backyard. He was old, and he had diarrhea. And I love dogs, and he's a house dog, and I don't kick dogs out. They're part of my life. But it was getting kind of troublesome. And he had all his long fur, and I know that for me, God knows I was the only one who would stand out there and hold him up when he needed to go, because by that time, nobody in the family was helping. But the snapshot scene that I recall is in that living room, looking at these people with my son leaping around with his lights flashing, and Cliff, real startled by that, talking to the television, my mother explaining it, and my daughter feeding us, and of course, the angry one just get close to me, and Chris standing on a chair singing, and Mary in her corner, and I remember standing there thinking, my God, look at these people. You know, my little mother, and I just felt like a failure. I remember how I felt. I felt responsible. What had I done wrong? And what can I do about it? And the dog would bark, and I knew what I could do. I'd take him out of the backyard and hold him up. And I'd rinse him off with a hose because he had diarrhea. But see, I'd lost track of my choices. It never occurred to me to cut off all that fur. I'd lose martyr points anyway, wouldn't I, if I cut off the fur. My life was just this narrow, busy, but narrow, with so few choices, all designed to control something somewhere. And one time, one kid looked scared, one time too many. And I had not grown up scared, and I just couldn't. It was Chris, and I couldn't anymore bear to see a child afraid. So Cliff delivered his famous line, which had been famous for 20 years by then. We'd been married 20 years at that time, and he said, "I think I'll just move out." Now, my famous line following that, I followed my script, was, "That's no way to solve things. You solve them by talking about them." Well, I didn't say that this time. I just said, "Good idea." We moved out, and that's when I began realizing how sick I had become, because my stomach ache went away. I didn't, when a kid came in the front door with something troubling them, I didn't rush them in the back of the house and say, "Keep quiet, don't let Daddy hear." I tended to my children better. And he went around the corner and joined AA again. I say around the corner because that's where his sponsor lived. He had been in and out of AA for 5 years, so what else is new? A big deal. But you see, something changed. For one thing, this couple, this man and woman in AA, Bill and Margie Blake, began taking me to meetings. AA meetings, which is good because then I could learn for him, keep track, remind him. And they put me in the car, they'd drive me up to Clancy's with them. Oh, and then we made there be a slowdown on the freeway, and everybody'd get very grumpy, all these five AAs and me. And I would say to them, "Let's consider this a gift of time." Don't say that to a car full of angry members of AA. Cheerio. See, I don't identify with alcoholics because I keep having feelings of impending joy. And I was doing it then. Well, it's a wonder I didn't get killed. But Margie took me up to Laguna Beach where she plucked me in an Al-Anon meeting. And actually, preceding that, Bill, who was always trying to get me to go to Al-Anon, he was like a little bandy rooster. He'd run through our house, say, "Leave the literature out." I'd give it to my neighbor who needed it. I was a psychology major. Thank you very much. I didn't need this stuff. And I would dismiss him. But he came in one day and said that he'd been to the Al-Anon meeting locally, and he thought they could use my help. The Al-Anon four-letter word, right? And I was at a meeting that night, and that was March 17th of 1970, which, if you think about it, is St. Patrick's Day. Is that an example of God's sense of humor? And I haven't gone away. The reason I haven't gone away is because you let me help you. You let me help you, and you needed it, that's for sure. You certainly needed organizing, and I was happy to do that. You told me you needed me, and I could see that you did. Thank God I was given the gift of love, unconditional love from you Al-Anons, because I was so arrogant, and I must have been absolutely disgusting to be around, and exhausting to be around, I would think. You never told me that. You let me do it and bloom in my own way. You gave me lots of little hints on how to start restructuring my life. And they were little hints. They were things like, "Let him be mad." Because I would say, "Well, I can't say that, he'll be mad." "Let him be mad." Well, it never occurred to me. Just let somebody be mad? What a concept, huh? You swept me into service because I knew I could help you. And from the Al-Anon service, Sandy mentioned that, that's been our life. Cliff was active in service. I learned through the AAs, and then I learned as well through the Al-Anons. Giving it away. Keeping AA and Al-Anon here for our kids, and you've been here for our kids. Because two of them are sober, and we don't know about that boy in Hawaii, but he's controlling his drinking right now. He's probably doing a little marijuana maintenance, but his liver is bad. He's controlling his drinking, and I don't know. I'm going over there first part of next month. We'll see. Cliff sent him the big book, and I said something about Cliff. David's been doing some reading. He said, "Oh, he's reading the big book?" I said, "No, he's reading about livers." Sound like a... We don't know. We'll go on there. We have a granddaughter who at the age of 14 discovered boys and booze and boys. I don't know what order. She's been on the streets a lot of times. And that's pretty hard when they're that little. And she's a beautiful little thing. And you know, we have to let go. And when our daughter, who is now sober, couldn't stay off of the stuff she was putting in her body so that her first baby only lived for 6 weeks. And she knew that. And when she had her second baby, he lived, but he was in terrible shape. And he, for 5 years, he was in and out of the hospitals in pain, going through what he had to go through partly because she couldn't keep the poisons out of her body. And I can talk about this now because she does. And I would go sit with her next to his bed, knowing what she must be feeling, that she had put him in this shape. She's sober almost 7 years now, and she has had a baby in sobriety, a full-term baby in sobriety, and that baby's a healthy baby, and that's a gift of the program. It was harder for me to sit with my daughter, knowing the pain she must be in, with her little son going through what he was going through, than whatever was, to watch my husband's drinking. There was nothing I could do for her pain. and she hadn't hit bottom yet. There was nothing I could do. And as parents, I know many of us, we don't know what to do. Usually it's nothing. Sometimes it's something. I know today that when I do anything for one of my kids or one of my grandchildren, it's because I need to do it for me, not to expect any change in them, because I need to know I've done that. And it may be different today than it was yesterday, and that's okay. I couldn't do too well with my own teenagers, so I sponsored Alateen groups. And out of that, and I coordinated the Alateen in San Diego County, and out of that I discovered the amount of incest that goes on in alcoholic families. Because when you're sponsoring an Alateen group, you're going to come across this. So as a result of that, and as a result of my Al-Anon service, I'm learning to have real confidence in myself and to understand and recognize what I could do. I went back and finished college. Then I kept going, kind of scared, startled Cliff a bit. He'd a little used to me working and earning money, and suddenly I disappeared for 5 years, went back through graduate school. So I work with those kind of families today. And I know I'm where I'm supposed to be, because I may be the only therapist in that whole bunch with these families that knows about alcoholism. And unfortunately, therapists like to take credit for things. I get to send people to AA and Al-Anon. I will never get rich in this business, because I send them all the meetings. But there's nothing more victorious for me than having a couple that sent to me for some other reason, and I begin noticing a little something that looks like alcoholism, and I'll bring that up and suggest he go to AA meetings, and I say, I won't charge you for your next session if you go to 3 meetings. The best victory for me is for that guy to come back and says, you know what, I don't think I need to come here anymore. I think I'll do just fine in meetings. You see? But see what is this Al-Anon hog heaven? I get paid to manipulate alcoholics into AA. And they don't know what hit them. And I'm not as popular with some of my fellow therapists because, you see, therapists have an ego. They want to do the curing. The curing doesn't happen there. But I had these wonderful traditions before I ever began that kind of work, and I had the wonderful example set to me. And I had trouble becoming a therapist because there's a lot of criticism of that out where we live. But I know how what I'm doing. And Cliff says it well. He says, what you do in your office is clinical. What we do in the program is spiritual. And I'll give you 12-step work in my program. I send them to meetings. And, you know, it's a wonderful life for me today. As I say, I'll probably never get rich because I sure do short-term therapy. I don't think most people need a lot, frankly. But I tell you, I never dreamed I'd be doing what I'm doing. Sitting in a room with men who've molested their daughters so I can report to the court about them, thinking, and being able to detach the person from the deed, because I learned here to detach the person from the disease and clearly know what I'm supposed to be doing. So it's kind of, I don't know what's ahead of me. I just try to do what this program taught me, which was to bloom right where I'm planted. Scared a lot of times. Scared. But you told me that fear is not a stoplight, it's a caution light. And it's true. Sometimes it's wise to... Sandy went through a red light last night, actually.
It was yellow the last time.
He said it was yellow the last time he looked at it. And the gifts you've given me can't... they don't stop. As long as I trust and walk through whatever door's in front of me. And that's what I do with you. And that's why when someone called us a long time ago, a year and a half, that if we could come and talk in Florida, we said, you bet. And thank you for that. Bye-bye.